You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I loved this conversation. We're talking to Elaine Lynn Herring, who is a facilitator, speaker, and writer. She has trained mental health professionals, political officials, religious communities, and leaders at companies including American Express, Google, Nike, Pixar, and the Red Cross. Herring is a former managing partner of Triad Consulting Group and a lecturer at Harvard Law School, specializing in dispute resolution, mediation, and negotiation. She's got a new book. It's called Unlearning Silence: How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Another like the one that comes next. The coin on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Elaine Lynn Herring, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
In the introduction to your book, you talk about a time in your work life when a colleague took credit for your work. That never happens. But no one spoke up. And they all knew he was taking credit for your work. And you write, quote, "I'm the model minority myth incarnate." Wow. Tell us more.
I am the youngest daughter of an immigrant family from Taiwan to the United States. I grew up in the Christian church. All of that basically tells me turn the other cheek, bite your tongue. To respect other people is to give deference to them, to not push back, to not ask questions. You're a good team player. And if no one else in that context is speaking up either, I guess that's just what happens around here.
And it's also a survival strategy, right? This is not without its meaning.
I am still waiting for my papers. I have them now, right? But I'm waiting for a green card. You don't want to get kicked out of the country. I just made it into this. I was the new hire, right? I'm trying to make it through the probationary period, for example. Or I finally made it to the C-suite and I finally have a seat at the table. I better not rock the boat. There's so much in the way that we operate, particularly if you carry subordinated identities, meaning a woman in a male-dominated environment, non-white person in a predominantly white environment, that if you carry a subordinated identity, you already are facing an uphill battle of being inherently othered, less likely to be invited to those conversations, more likely to be questioned. So it is even greater risk for me to stick my hand up, test the waters, and say, hey, actually, it was me. Give me credit. And by the way, I wasn't raised that way, right? I was raised to put my head down, work hard, and people are going to reward you for it. So how could I challenge someone who's senior to me, who's been here longer, who has more organizational, institutional, and hierarchical power? I mean, that just seems, it's not a bet I want to take.
I just interviewed Jerry Colonna, and I think his podcast is going to air after our conversation. And he has written this very powerful leadership book, which is about generational trauma. And I'm like, this keeps coming up.
None of that here.
No, none of that here. No, everyone look away. Yeah. But I mean, it's so valuable in the sense that all of us are shaped inside these family scripts, these family dynamics, where you learn when not to talk. I mean, I remember, and I'm the youngest of six, Irish-English family, and we used to have all these wild conversations at the dinner table, and that's who we were. But there were also things that we didn't talk about in terms of certain family members and relatives. And it was like years later going, why was that not talked about?
And everybody knows.
Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows that we're not supposed to talk about it. These are the norms and the patterns, the contours of silence that we either perpetuate, internalize, or talking about generational trauma if we want to break the cycle.
Right.
But that carries risk too. I mean, there's risk in any regard. There's cost in every direction. It's really, A, are we analyzing the costs and benefits accurately? And B, what is worth it to us?
Yeah, you point out, and I've seen this stat before, that kids ask roughly 125 questions per day, and adults ask 6 questions per day. I don't know about you, but as I've aged, I have realized every year that I age that I know less,
mm-hmm.
and that I need to ask more questions, and mm-hmm. things are more complex, and they're mm-hmm. deeper, and they're nuanced. So we're going the wrong direction.
Well, if everybody would just be more like Kelly, then we would be in a better world.
I don't know about that. No, I don't know. No. There's many people who disagree with that.
And that would be good because they would be using their voice and offering a difference of opinion.
That's true. This book is written from your life and your perspective, but you also open that door to, we all have these different experiences that we're bringing with us into work. And I remember early on, as I transitioned from being a comedy and theater producer to working in these spaces, this idea of like, why is it that we check our humanity at the door mm-hmm. when we go into our office, when that is in fact a superpower of ours?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a superpower that comes with all that sort of mess. Again, useful for figuring mm-hmm. out the messes that we're walking into, because it's not like the workplace is any different.
No, and our inability to hold mess, acknowledge mess, the amount of energy we have to expend to silence those parts of ourselves. Let's just take emotions as mm-hmm. an example, right? The emotions are in that room with you in the meeting, whether or not they are externally expressed. And if they're not externally expressed or acknowledged, they usually bubble out and leak out anyways, in the form of tone or curtness or that look that you exchange with someone. And it fuels our inability to have those conversations over time. How I came to this is certainly my lived experience, but it is also more than a decade of teaching leadership development workshops around communication skills for negotiation, difficult conversations, and feedback. And noticing that however much money the company's paid, however good the training might be, some people still didn't have those conversations. Why is that? Because we've all learned silence and in our careers been rewarded for it. Right? If you don't say something, you don't rock the boat. If you don't say something, you're easy to work with, and that is prized. If you don't say something, we can end this meeting because it was a waste of time anyways. But over time, it also creates a culture of silence where I guess we just don't talk about things here because we don't see our leaders dissenting, discussing, debating in a healthy way. But that also leads, as we know, to groupthink and to echo chambers and Albert Hirschman's analysis in the 70s of if you have 3 options, voice, exit, or loyalty. If you use your voice and it's not heard, then your choices are exit, leave the company, and then you're left with only the people who are loyal, which then is a bunch of yes people with no yeah. yes and.
No, there's no and in that.
There's no and there. And we get the Challenger and we get Boeing and we get Enron and, you know, every single scandal, the last, I would argue, I haven't dug into the research, but all of humanity, in part because when people spoke up, we didn't hear them.
Yeah.
And we didn't build an environment that said, yeah, we actually do want to hear that. Because speaking up is not efficient in the moment. It's messy
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and it's uncomfortable. But the trade-off down the line isn't all that great. It's just down the line. I may not be here in 6 months anyway, so it will be someone else's mess to clean up.
Yeah, this is the benefit of working at a comedy theater, which is it's all about saying the things that go yeah. unsaid.
Yes.
That's the thing that people are responding to.
Totally.
And it's not always easy to then offstage put that in a boardroom, but we do it. And, mm-hmm. and actually, our saving grace is that we like to laugh. So we do it in a way that's like, oh, I'm serious about this thing I'm saying to you, but I'm going to say it in a humorous way we can all laugh. And that's the elephant. That's the way you sort of treat the elephant in the room. I think you're going to dig this. So I was finishing, or I was reading your book, and I was on the road. And I don't know if you know this, we created a improvisation for caregivers program with our friend Ai-Jen Poo.
Ooh,
at
nice.
Caring Across Generations. Yes, it's a brilliant and very dear friend, but it's all about bringing improvisational skill into this caregiving space. And you know, I'm a dad, and I was a son, and so I know about this, but they were teaching me things I didn't know. Mm. And then you plucked out this quote from the sociologist Jessica Calarco, who literally maybe 20 minutes after I read this, her publicist pitched me to have her come on the podcast.
Oh, fun.
I booked her.
So the world is revolving around you and this podcast is what I hear. Just to be clear about my narrative.
It might be revolving around you because you introduced me to her.
You're welcome.
This quote is devastating.
It is.
Can you?
I'm going to let you read it.
Okay. The quote is, other countries have social safety nets. The U.S. has women. 1,000% true.
Yeah. Also, thanks for doing the work. I didn't want to read it because that would be more labor for me to do. So thanks, Kelly, for taking one for the team.
You got it. This has come up, though. We interviewed an economist who talked about the fact that this is invisible work.
Yes.
It doesn't mean it's really important work, and it doesn't show up in the GDP.
Trillions of dollars. Caregiving is a bigger industry than most industries. The auto industry, you know, sort of name it.
Yes.
And we fundamentally devalue it. We don't pay for it. And it is predominantly those roles are held by women. So yeah, other countries have social safety nets that are imperfect. Let's be clear, but there's a baseline there. Mm-hmm. So God forbid a woman has a child, births a human being and needs to take some time off an office job to heal and recover from that. Why would we pay for that? To be really clear, in case anybody is missing the sarcasm and the tone here, that was one of the policies I pushed through at my last firm before leaving.
Yeah.
Which is to say, look, we can afford to pay for this because it makes a difference. If we do not offer this policy, it disproportionately silences people who want to birth and raise children.
Yeah.
And it is true, if we look at all of our policies, to ask the question, who does this policy support? Who does it silence? That's part of why years later, 4 years later, we're still talking about a return to office policy. Because that policy disproportionately silences people who have long commutes, typically lower income, and the breakdown across race and gender maps with the people who are silenced by the requirement. There is a disproportionate hurdle to get into the office every day.
We were just in Atlanta visiting, my wife Anne and I were visiting our son, who is he quit his corporate job to be an actor. Mm. Totally our fault.
You're owning it.
I am owning it. And we often say to him, we're sorry we gave you the illusion you could make a living in theater. and he's very clear. He's like, no, I'm aware of that. But we were asking, we're like, so, you know, he's 26. And we're like, when you were growing up, like, what were you modeling? He's like, you guys worked all the time. He goes, dad more than mom. Mm. But that actually was not true. And it was, you know, we were both executives at Second City, but I had to travel more. And so she had to pick up all of that for both of our kids. Mm-hmm. And it was really sort of, and again, having done this work now as we get older and we move into these other spaces, you recognize that, oh my God, like we're part of the system.
We're all part of the system.
It's inequitable and we know it. It's not like the science isn't there that is so you're looking to change a narrative.
Mm.
And my question was, were you, is that something you were doing before you decided to write the book, or is it all of a piece?
People often ask me, what's the most surprising thing about researching and writing this book? Like, what did you learn? And my answer is, I learned that I have a voice.
Okay.
It's funny to me. I was tagged on LinkedIn the other day. Someone was like, you know, tell me about which intersectional feminist speakers I should be booking. And someone said Elaine Lynn Herring. And I was like, that's me.
Yeah.
I didn't set out to be an intersectional feminist speaker. I don't identify as that. I identify first as a human being. Second, as a wife, as a mother, as a friend, as someone who is trained as a lawyer, as an educator, a facilitator. But does that characterization align with my values? Absolutely. Did I go into this thinking I had a voice? No.
Hmm.
And part of that is, you know, my family background that I mentioned. Part of it is I grew up professionally, as many of us do, with mentors and colleagues who then became my business partners. And my job was to teach their work and to amplify their tools and concepts, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about me. It wasn't about my voice. It wasn't about my own thoughts. And I thought the value I brought in a room was because I was teaching these concepts out of the Harvard Negotiation Project that have been, you know, they have a stamp of approval from someone else.
Yeah.
And how could I challenge them or evolve them? But if I also take the stance that I imagine so many of us listeners and you and I hold of continuous learning and asking more questions, think we're always asking the question of what's missing. And so I came to silence because despite a lot of corporate training, corporate education, that financial investment, that energy investment, that time investment, some people still didn't have the difficult conversations, still wouldn't negotiate, still wouldn't give and receive feedback, no matter how much their manager or HR tried to make them do it. Why is that? And I landed on, oh, because we've each learned silence. We've been rewarded for it. And we perpetuate it. The people around us sort of want to keep those things in place. And so I thought, this actually seems like, let me test this hypothesis. It seemed to resonate with clients. I pitched the book, very much thinking like, I don't know if anyone's going to be interested. 16 publishers were interested. We did a 2-day auction. Right. Turns out there was a thought and that pushes a conversation forward. I am not the be all keeper of silence. I hope the book pushes the conversation forward and helps us to continue to learn. And I hope someone else pokes holes in it and says, here's what's missing and how do we evolve that? But I have learned in this process that I have a voice. And that gives me hope and reminds me that it is possible for each of us to evolve, to find our voices if we feel like we've lost them, to create space to do things differently than how they've been done, because unlearning silence is going to require each of us.
Yeah. There's another thing that you do in the book that I think strikes the heart of another dilemma that we have in our society today. And that is, it is absolutely vital that each of us discover our voice and those many different us's that exist. And they are many. We are, that is not an inconsistency. We are different at different times and different places. We also don't do this alone.
Yes.
And this is, I don't know why this is such a problem now for people to understand, which is how thoroughly dependent we are on each other. I mean, you've got the longest study that Harvard's ever done that says at the end of the day, it's about love and relationships.
Yeah.
And then we know, we all work in teams. No, you can be an artist, you know, on your own in your farm, and someone else is going to need to, at some point, engage with your
yes.
work to get it out in the world. None of us do this alone.
Correct.
And why do those things fight each other? Because they shouldn't.
Because at least in America, it seems like individualism is a value. And because we have narratives like self-made billionaire, no one is a self-made billionaire.
No.
Right? No, no one.
No one.
From, oh, are you driving on that street?
Yeah.
Someone, taxpayers, which was everybody, paid for that street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to diminish their accomplishment, but I think that prizing, that elevating of individualism really sends the message that it's about an individual rather than a collective. And the people who are held up in those instances aren't quick to, you know, distribute credit. Second is people are messy.
Mm-hmm.
I say that lovingly, but no buts. And I say that lovingly. I have enough that I'm working through on my own to have to deal with yours too. And on a team, y'all, that's like six different family generational traumas that intersect in different ways. And we're in different parts of our journey. So we may not be aware. I have enough to deal with of my own. How do I navigate yours as well? I'd argue that the way that we navigate is by actually discussing it, naming it, sharing awarenesses, and all of that is, here's my hypothesis of how I work today. Here's my hypothesis of how the world works today. Can we make it discussable rather than staying in our silent silos where then we still do the same thing? I'm still telling a story about you. Mm-hmm. You just have no chance to correct it because you don't know what it is. And in doing that, I get to maintain control. I maintain my fixed mindset. I know how Kelly is. This is his character sketch. There is no evolution. I also miss out on who you could be, who we could be, what we could figure out together. Those are a couple of reasons.
Yeah. I think another benefit of working where I work is in the improvisational field, we have ensembles. And one of the things that is so fascinating is, what is Second City known for except producing stars? Every one of those people have dedicated themselves to a philosophy where they make their partner look good.
Yeah, I love that.
My job is to save you. Your job is to save me. That is our agreement. That is our norm. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't preclude individual success. But I remember Harold Ramis, like very early in my career, I remember him saying the best kind of success is shared success.
Mm.
And I just, that is entirely true. And it's the mess. I mean, you talk about that. Totally true. It's ridiculous. But that's where the good stuff is.
Yes.
That's where the funniest stuff is. That's where the smartest stuff is. And it's like, no, you got to get your hands dirty. If it is easy, you're likely doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I say that across domains. Parenting, you know, relationships,
yeah.
Work. The good stuff is struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think what's really interesting in the book, there were two quotes I pulled out. And this is in chapter 3, When Silence Makes Sense. Mm-hmm. And you say one of them is, ignoring race was how I could stay in the field. Not explicitly, of course, but implicitly. And you said also, I didn't realize how weary I was from trying to stay in white spaces. The dominant figures, and I would be that, a straight white cis male, for the most part, we don't even understand the power we have.
Mm-hmm. Power is invisible to those who have it.
Yeah. And it's extremely visible to people from so-called marginalized communities who see truth in a certain way because they have to, because it's life and death. It is not that for me.
And I'm glad that you're asking questions and that you're reading books like mine. I mean, this is the tension I feel with really well-intentioned people in my life who have said to me, hey, tell me what it's like to be Asian American in the United States. And I'm like, I choose silence, right? Chapter 3 exists for a reason. Because also in my head, I'm like, go Google it.
Yeah.
It's 2020. It was 2022, 2023 when I was writing the book. Now it's 2024. The Google searches, the results are there. So why are we asking the people in our lives who often feel tokenized to do that emotional labor. Oh, because we're used to when we ask the question to get a response and the people around us would offer it to us because it is a centering in the conversation. Mm-hmm. I wrote, I think it made the final cut. You know, this book went through so many iterations, and the question that publishers always ask is, who's the book for? Mm-hmm. And I have two hopes and aims with the book. You can tell me if they come through. One is that people who have been marginalized and silenced feel seen, known, and heard. Because the problem has always been positioned as, you're the problem. If you're not getting heard, it's because you need to have more confidence, more courage. You need to be more direct, less direct. You need to smile more, smile less, whatever it is. Tie yourself up in knots and you still can't get it right.
Yeah.
I would say the problem is there's this thing called silence that we've all learned. What are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And you didn't make it up because we are silencing each other. The second hope and aim and demographic is well-intentioned leaders. Mm-hmm. Because doing leadership development, I did a ton of diagnostic calls where the leaders are saying, I keep asking my people. I want people to speak up. I want to know. I want to build this collaborative, safe, productive, effective environment. But no one's going to say anything. No one says anything. And I'm really frustrated. And we've run every employee survey. And the anonymous ones tell us something. But when I ask someone directly, I don't get any intel. And the people that report to them will say to me, the external, yeah, here are all the things that make it hard that they're doing, but I could never tell them, and wanting to bridge that gap. So chapters 5 and 9 about the ways that we silence other people and how to stop silencing people, that's a diagnostic checklist for any well-intentioned leader to say, might I be doing any of these things? The first is just forgetting how hard it is for some people to speak up because of their lived history and because their voice has not been welcome or normalized. Back to you.
Yeah, I was flashing back, and not in a great way, it was an actor who was leaving, and he hadn't sort of completed his work here, and he was upset, and I think I said something like, my door is always open, and he's like, that doesn't matter. What you didn't do is bring me in. And I really thought about that for a while, and it's haunted me over time, and I've changed in the sense that if I have to have a difficult conversation with someone, or I think I need to have that, or get to someone, I have a setup now. I'm beyond my desk as we're talking, but I have two chairs that are at the same level, and I move to that chair. Mm-hmm. And so there's like, I need to physically move myself out of this barrier that's in front of me. There's a very noted social scientist who's work people know, but I was friends with someone who was one of his postdocs, and I found out later that he kept his chair 3 inches higher than any other chair in a room. Now, that's
such a social science experiment.
It's such, but it was not an experiment. It was a choice. It was choice architecture, and I'm not talking about Richard Thaler. It wasn't Thaler.
I love that you set the record straight.
There's another part of the book, and this is something that I was in a conversation with some colleagues.
Also, I'm going to plug really quickly. Megan Reitz's Harvard Business Review article, why saying my door is open is problematic, because you started to touch on it, but there's a deep analysis there that is really worth anyone reading. Essentially, that you have a door means that you hold power.
Yes.
Because you can invite people onto your turf or kick them out. You control the terms and conditions on which we engage rather than co-creating. And that is power, but we don't realize it because it's just normal.
Yeah.
I've always had an office. I've always had a door.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. And so that requires either a changing of norms in a variety of ways that that can be physical, that can be verbal. It's probably all those things, but then nothing. I was running back here to get here for the podcast, and cause I was out with my boss, and I was also realizing like, we got to get out of the office more. When we go and talk to people in their place and on their terms, you learn all kinds of things, and it's just too easy to sort of stay in one place.
Yeah.
The other thing, so it's this three buckets thing that you talk about. This is awesome. So this, the chapters about how we silence others, I think that this buckets idea, though, is just like good for everything. And basically, the three buckets are those who decide, those to consult, and those who need to be informed. We added a fourth bucket on here for my team, which was also those who then execute.
Yeah, sure. Racy does that.
Yeah,
Racy is the framework.
And again, then someone's like, yeah, we have Racy on your framework. And I'm like, oh, is that what that means?
Yeah. So
talk about the buckets, both in terms of, like, I imagine you use this. This is why you put this in here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you use this in a given day?
I use this primarily in coaching. Okay. But also because it helps reduce the friction in human interaction. So yesterday someone said to me, you know, I have to go pitch this idea to my boss and I'm really nervous. And I said, okay, well, who's the decision maker at the end of the day? Who makes the decision? And they're like, my boss does. And I was like, okay, so then your job is to say, here's the problem that everyone agrees exists. Here is an option that I think, based on my expertise and research and efforts, think will work, and they get to decide.
Yeah.
And if they make, as a matter of a business decision, a different decision than you would have made, okay, that's on them.
Yeah.
But it's not a personal failing because you couldn't convince them. Where we run into trouble is a couple of areas. One is we assume that we are joint decision makers.
Mm-hmm.
And we may not agree on who is actually making the decision. And so people keep escalating, and there's no accountability, and it's inefficient and it's painful for everyone. So one is, who's the decision maker? And if we're not clear, let's negotiate that first. Second is the pressure as a leader to be inclusive, particularly in this day and age. And we translate that and operationalize it in saying, okay, to be inclusive, I've got to go poll everyone. I got to go ask Kelly, and I got to ask that person and that person. And the reality is we cannot run businesses and run this world on consensus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not personal. It's not that I don't care what Kelly thinks. It's, as a practical matter, you know, the CEO should not be consulted on what snacks are going to be at the all staff meeting. Some CEOs want to be, let's be clear.
Yeah,
and we all know them, and we know their preferences, because that is power. But as a matter of efficiency for shareholders, that's not what a CEO should be spending their time and energy on. So the three buckets allows us to say, in each decision, each topic, there are different roles. And we rotate the roles based on the topic and the issue. And there's not offense taken if I am consulted. My job is to advocate as hard as I can for what I think the best solution is. But if you decide differently, okay, I'll get on board, because I'm not the decision maker. But the trap is, people say, leaders say, I want to know what you think. And so people think I'm in the consult bucket, but then the leader doesn't actually listen, because that person was actually in the inform bucket. And then people are like, well, there's no use to using my voice. They were going to do what they were going to do anyways. Leaders, if there's always a process and we've got to keep moving, if you're not in a point in the process where you can actually hear someone's opinion, or from the stakeholder analysis, they're in the inform bucket, not the consult bucket, that clarity is what helps with effectiveness, rather than the friction that comes from thinking, well, Kelly's just doing lip service again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Leadership doesn't really listen to us anyway, so why should I spend the time and energy? This is about energy allocation and being able to be really clear about that. And of course, because you mentioned the buckets work most everywhere, the example I use in the book is around dating.
Yeah.
And culturally, right? Is who you date, is dating a team sport or an individual sport? I'm curious your take, actually.
Oh, well, no, in my Irish, it was an individual sport.
Mm-hmm.
In my world, it was absolutely a team sport. In your world, I don't know if that's the entire Asian diaspora.
Well, they're collective and individual cultures, so there's some cultural contribution there.
But I would say, overwhelmingly, in terms of my friends, that's very teamy.
Well, so let's be clear, though, of what paradigm we're using.
Uh-huh.
And also, that helps when well-intentioned people in my life have input.
Mm-hmm.
on the other people in my life or how my friends are, you know, all these things. Okay, great. I know that actually if they're in the inform bucket, I don't really need to listen to their input. That's right. I've actively consulted them, great. You know, there's a short list of people who I'm like, we all need each other. Life is a team sport. I trust you enough to give me tough love and to tell me things as they actually are. I'm not going to see things as clearly for myself as I do for others. So I'm going to have a short list of people I consult, and I can decide whether I'm deciding or if we're jointly deciding. But that mental clarity actually helps with a lot of the friction in receiving feedback or knowing how to metabolize it as well.
Yeah. Can we talk about feedback?
Sure.
Okay. So as you could probably guess, in a sort of a theater, an improvisational theater, there's instantaneous feedback, which is mm-hmm. laughing or not laughing. Mm-hmm. There are coaches in improv. There are coaches. There's directors in Second City. Yeah. But there's all that language is in there. I just found out today from my friend Julie, who helps run our training centers here, that more and more we're finding young people don't want feedback. When a teacher is saying, here's my note on the scene, like I don't want your note.
Why?
They paid a lot for these classes and they want to have a good time and they don't. And it's funny, when I brought this up to someone on the business side of here, they're like, oh no, that's the HR has told me they're experiencing that with even work people in the workforce here. And there's a phrase in our work, and I want to explain it to you, which is take the note. And the idea there is you don't have to agree with the note. You don't have to actually do the note. You just take it. And if you have a question or a clarifying comment, you get there mm-hmm. because all these notes are ideas for you to improve for mm-hmm. the sake of the show or the mm-hmm. ensemble or mm-hmm. yourself.
Yeah.
There's sort of directional on that. And it is not, in our work, it is never like you have to say X, Y, Z. It's more mm-hmm. like, I'm looking for this.
Yeah.
And I'm curious from you, like is the idea of like this idea that we're losing the ability to incorporate feedback, is that showing up on your doorstep at all?
Yeah. And there's a bunch of you know, research around the trophy generation of everyone gets a reward. And so you're used to that. So it's harder to take that. I'm so glad that you explained the term of art, because I've heard take the note and thought yep. it meant I have to take it. I have to implement it, versus what I hear from you is much aligned with my stance on feedback, mm-hmm. which is it's data. Uh-huh. It's data. You get to decide what you want to do with it. Going back to the three buckets, this is the mental clarity of feedback is people in the consult bucket giving you information. You are in the decide bucket, sometimes alone, deciding right. whether you want to implement, operationalize, bring it to life. Just because someone gives you feedback doesn't actually mean you have to take it, because it could be biased. It could be not right for you. But I, as an individual, having paid to go to this session, would want all the intel, all the data, all the value I could get of it, so that I can figure out what I want to do. Feedback is data. It is not definitive.
Yeah. And I can't even imagine any medium. Let's say you're a dancer. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're mm-hmm. a baseball player. What, like, you're not getting coaching? Mm-hmm. Like, and the crucial nature of mentorship with regard to performance. Mm-hmm. We just had Cal Newport on the pod with his mm-hmm. new book, Slow Productivity. Yeah. And this idea that we would literally have no science that points to what is productivity for a knowledge worker. Mm-hmm. Our stuff is like, well, they're in the office. They have yeah. lots of meetings. They're busy. Yeah. And like, no.
Yeah.
So they're zero.
Yeah.
And yet we both work in business where everyone's talking about ROI. They all talk about EBITDA. They all talk about data, except when it comes to the human beings who are doing the work.
Yeah. And are we having that conversation?
No, we are not.
Which is the power of silence and our ability to live in a skewed reality. if we are not actively having the conversations about the things, right? Saying the quiet parts out loud, naming what is often unsaid, it's still there. It's still impacting us, whether or not we acknowledge it. Do you want it to creep out and leak out, or do you want to have agency in driving it and how we process through it together?
All right, so we're not talking about that. We're not talking about the failures of our healthcare systems. We're not talking about the fact that schooling is wrong, that it's built on an industrial like paradigm that makes no sense whatsoever.
This is why books are banned, Kelly.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And this is why we continue to have the conversation. Now, I will say for me, to be part of the conversation is a calculation. People often say using your voice, wow, that takes so much courage, or, you know, you need to have more confidence. To me, it's calculation based on the school that I went to and have taught in, based on my work experience to date. I have a tremendous amount of privilege to name the things that would be really costly for other people to name. It's also not to say that this process hasn't been costly for me. If you look at my professional biography, part of this authorship publishing journey is that I am no longer a partner at the firm that I was at.
Mm-hmm.
But if we have one life to live, the question becomes, how do we want to live it? And what choices do we want to make going forward? And having this conversation, I think we're getting to a more accurate diagnosis of the situation, which allows us to actually move forward intentionally rather than living in ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. I mean, your life is a yes and story, but can you narrow down one?
I'll try because I think the yes and is using your voice can be really costly and really rewarding, both from having agency over your life and impact in the world, but to not just perpetuate the status quo, but to move us forward. And you can be terrified and you can be hopeful. The question I'm getting most these days are, you know, are you so excited your book's going to be in the world? And I'm like, no, people tend to be concerned. I don't see the lack of excitement given the current state of the world and the stakes in our own political system, in our global community. I don't see lack of excitement as problematic or a flaw. I see it as an acknowledgement of holding both and.
Mm-hmm.
We can hold deep pain and we can also have hope for the future. I really want to end this conversation on a more positive note, but maybe the most honest note I can end it on is one of emotional honesty, which is yes and, right? Yes to the pain and the weight, and yes to the hope of a different way.
There's no suffering without joy. There's no joy without suffering.
Really? Why? Because I only want the good stuff.
That is the ancient wisdom that was handed down to us that we keep forgetting has already been said, taught. We've been taught this forever. And it's interesting. I think, you know, Dan Pink's last book on regret was very interesting in this regard, which is sort of like, regret is not always a bad thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and allowing us to frame things that happen or, you know, doing something because we don't want to be regretful mm-hmm. later.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's the same idea that there's no bad and good stress. Mm-hmm. There's just stress. And you can utilize it as a performer in really exciting, excellent ways. And it can also defeat you mm-hmm. when you allow it to.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide, as human beings, these qualifiers,
yeah.
when in fact it's just what life is, and it's these things are inevitable, and we all have these tragedies. And when I was giving this talk yesterday in Toronto, I've talked about this before. I think my friend Heidi Brooks, who teaches at Yale, does a new thing with her. Every time she has a new cohort, she passes around a blank piece of paper and a pen. She goes, "Don't write your name. Just write down a pain that you're experiencing right now." She gathers up the paper and reads every piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
What an incredible gift to that room. they don't need to know the person. They just said like, oh no, that all these things are going on in this room. And additionally, we're all here to learn at a great college. And so all these things, it's all true. It's sad. It's beautiful. I don't know, man. It's that same way of the last like 3 years or so when people ask you how you're doing. And my answer is all like fantastic and terrible. How are you?
I love that. Yes. And
go ahead.
Yeah. The part I want to emphasize on that. I think yes. And we often emphasize the and also the yes. Right. Yes to continuing to show up and ask questions. Yes to continuing to learn. Yes to continuing to experiment. Yes to showing up for each other to name the things and hold space for one another. So thank you for yes and for and.
The book is called Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. Elaine Lynn Herring, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive from adulthood. No one survives.